Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
All right, Chris, thank you so much for joining me. Really looking forward to talking about your book, your experience at the CFTC, and your early days as a lawyer.
Thank you, Jacob. Thanks for this opportunity to speak to you and, more importantly, speak to your great audience of listeners. You've built quite a following, and so it's a great chance for me to tell that story. Thank you.
So I thought we could start with why this time is different. And in Crypto Dad, you write that it's now time to take a stand for the future of economic privacy and financial liberty. And there have been recurring threats to both throughout history. But are we at an acute inflection point with the creation of a digital-based monetary system now?
I think in your question is something of the answer. I'm always reluctant to say this time is different, because I actually think there's historic parallels for what we're going through. But what this time is much more than the emergence of some funny new asset class, some new tradable instrument, like the new form of, digital commodities or something. This is about a new architecture of finance. The architecture that we've been using, that we use today, is actually in human history not that old. It goes back to the 1600s. The notion that most forms of value are not in our pocket or under our mattress or in a hole in the ground in our backyard, but actually exist as liabilities on the balance sheet of commercial institutions or government-controlled banks or government-controlled registries like county records offices that record the titles to our homes or record the titles to our car, or banks that record our what we've saved for retirement and our net worth, or central banks that record the liabilities of those commercial banks. That system only goes back to the 1600s, when the Bank of Amsterdam said, put your physical tokens, your Venetian ducats or your Dutch guilders in our basement where it's safe, and we'll give you basically an IOU. We'll give you a banknote or others. That system in human history, while it seems somewhat intuitive to us today, is actually not intuitive to humankind. For most of human history, value was kept in a physical token. That token may have been a herd of sheep. It may have been a cow. It may have been a shell or a bead or a clay tablet, or it may have been in more recent times, a metal disc with a king or an emperor's head on it. But value was stored in physical instruments that we exchanged from one for the other. It's only, as I say, in the post-Renaissance period, where the emergence of first European and then global trade made it clear that carrying those tokens around was unwieldy and it was somewhat dangerous. You could get robbed and lose all your value. So it was easier to put your value in a bank vault, get a banknote that you could then take to the next town or the next country, and in return receive credit, not on your necessary value, but on the bank's standing and relationships. So the system we have today, there's nothing written in stone that it should go on and on. It's the system we've used for 400 years. But now there's a new architecture. And it's a new architecture that says, why are we recording value on a commercial bank balance sheet? Didn't we just see three major banks go bankrupt in the last year? And but for government insurance, people would have lost all their value. So isn't that kind of an odd system? It reminds us, doesn't it, of how we used to record information through central intermediaries, and we then discovered the internet, and we actually posted that information online and made it far more accessible. And so why don't we record value on networks or a network of networks like the internet. And so what Bitcoin is, what Ethereum is basically algorithmic protocols to record value online. It's in some ways, what Bitcoin is to value is what HTML or HTTP are to recording information online. So while everybody gets so caught up, especially politicians, in Bitcoin and others as funky new tradable assets, the more fundamental impact of them is a new architecture of recording value. Okay. To me, that to answer your first question, the reason why this moment, I don't know if it's different, but I do think we're at one of those historical inflection points where we're going from one architecture to a new architecture. And I think one of the historical parallels is the actually invention of the printing press. Before the invention of the printing press, information was very centralized. The information about the origins of humankind was basically a monopoly kept by the Catholic Church, at least in the Western European tradition. And the printing press not only allowed people to democratize information, but it actually allowed them to move away from a monopoly of one central authority to people claiming, to some degree, their own authority over what was the truth of the human experience. And that led to the Reformation, but it also led to a huge technological advancement of Europe. It's interesting, the historian Neil Ferguson writes that those European cities that embraced the printing press, that built presses in their city, became for the next several centuries, the leading commercial centers of Europe. And those cities that pushed back against the emergence of the printing press became backwaters. And so I think the parallel to what we're seeing now is a whole transformation in the way we record and store and access value. And to me, that's the great import. And is it any surprise that we're seeing a pushback, almost a reaction to this by not only traditional financial institutions, and I actually think traditional financial institutions are quite open to it. Many of them are, the more forward-leaning ones are, but amongst the regulators and the policymakers that in a sense have built their careers on the traditional financial system and are afraid of this technological transformation. But the last point I'll make is rear guard actions never stop technology. They didn't stop the printing press. They're not going to move this. To think that somehow banking and finance and even money are immune from the revolution of the internet, that what's going to happen to them is not going to happen, but it did happen. What happened to the internet of information and the way we conduct retail transactions, the way we share information, the way we do social media, the way we observe entertainment, all of that's been transformed by the internet, but somehow it's not going to happen to banking, to finance. It's just naive. It is. And so my thrust of all of my public statements is, rather than try to resist this, let's own it. Let's actually take it, shape it, and make it something that enhances human society, the human existence, the human condition, as opposed to something that various elites would tell us that we should not engage with. I think we should openly embrace it, but embrace it to make our lives better and those of our fellow human beings.
It's no wonder you have the title Crypto Dad, but I think it's very apt at what you said, because your perspective is based on studying history, and it's clear in the perspectives you give, whether it's what was happening in Amsterdam in the 1600s or post-Renaissance periods. And that's based on you going back and looking throughout history and seeing there were these new technologies and there were these incumbents that had a monopoly over whether it was information, whether it was the monetary system. And you saw how that played out over time. And you use the phrase rear guard action never ends up winning. And of course, that's the case. But it doesn't seem like that sentiment is always shared among regulators, among entrepreneurs, and among, frankly, the traditional financial regime. Do you think that is... And I won't ask you to speculate on why that's the case, but if you were to advise someone who might be in another jurisdiction or in a country where they're finding it difficult and they're speaking to regulators quite often, but they're running into a bit of resistance from, we want to keep things the way they are, how would you recommend advocating, or how do you advocate for an understanding and embracing a technology rather than fearing from it?
I think one has to be thoughtful. I think one has to be respectful. I'm a big believer in the role of regulators. I've seen too many bad actors and too much bad activity to want to disintermediate the role. I think regulation plays an important role. The important role that regulation should play is to allow the 99% of good people in every marketplace certainty to conduct their activities, knowing that the 1% of bad actors will be taken out and sanctioned appropriately. So I think regulation has an important play, but regulation should never be value-based, where it's choosing one market structure over another, choosing one technology over another, they're choosing, attempting to choose the future state. Regulation should, I think, be reactive to changes in technology and changes in market movement. So I think it's an important role for regulator, but not to be picking winners and losers. But I do think that as a free citizenry, we should approach regulators respectfully, thoughtfully, and we should have a degree of patience. I know this might be infuriating. When I was younger, I had no patience. One of the things life gives you is a sense of perspective. And I have children of my own that are beginning their careers, and I love their impatience to get on with things. But I think the thing that I've learned over time is nothing happens that fast. One needs to be incremental. One needs to be thoughtful. One needs to be principled. Don't back down. Assert the value proposition that you believe in, but understand that society can only adjust to change so fast. And those people that are holding back, they will be the ones that will have to have their actions judged by history. I'm sure there were people that resisted early aviation and transportation by airplane and insisted perhaps that even that the first aviation transportation abided by rules that were meant for railroad transportation. But we evolved rules that were specific to aviation. And aviation superseded railroad transportation as the main means of getting around continental United States and crossing the Atlantic. It superseded steamships. In a similar way, this new architecture will supersede previous forms of architecture. And there will be some who say this new technology needs to follow the old rules. But in time, a society as aspirational as the United States will realize that we can't hamper this innovation. What we've got to do is create a customized set of rules that are appropriate for it so that we can utilize it in the way that most enhances citizens in a free society.
And we will talk on the digital money and a future with digital money, where how we can implement a form of democratic values in that. Because I do agree that we are at an inflection point, especially because there's never been a technology that can be both so centralized and so decentralized at the same time. And that simultaneous sort of dichotomy is very interesting to me, in the sense that when things begin to get built out, they could take one of two paths. It can be a state-controlled currency where you have a social credit system similar to China, or it can be a cash adjacent or cash similar system like you have in the United States. So it will be interesting.
I think it'll be all of the above, Jacob. I think when I look into the future, I feel like I'm looking into one of those old kaleidoscopes we had as a kid, where the future is just going to be a kaleidoscope of both decentralized systems and centralized systems. And some of those centralized systems will be run by governments. Some will be run by private actors like banks, mm-hmm. and others run by big tech companies like stablecoin operators. And some will be very susceptible to government pressure. To censor, to surveil, and maybe even control. And some will be more free than others. And that kaleidoscope is going to be one that's going to be, I think, very challenging, especially for the mindset of those of us from the post-war period, where basically everything was based upon the dollar. American banks stepped astride the globe like Colossus, and U.S. style of regulation and U.S. central banking were basically the ones that called the tune. I think that system is going to yield to a much greater kaleidoscope of systems, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. I think you're going to see CBDCs exported as an export product by some countries like China and others. And I think you're going to see a proliferation of different forms of CBDC, but I think you're going to see a proliferation of different stablecoins. And by the way, some of those stablecoins will be interoperable and some won't. So it's going to be a very more of a kaleidoscope future than I think more than a telescope past.
Yeah, it's a good point where things evolve on their own. There won't just be a perfectly black and white pattern in the future. There will be all sorts of things happening, and things will be created in Canada. Things will be created in the US, and they'll all be growing at the same time and interact in ways we can't predict. I want to rewind a few years, not too many, but a couple years to when you were practicing in the UK. And I love in your book, you give your sort of origin story and how you built up a practice there before returning to America. And you wrote An Entrepreneur's Guide to Doing Business in the US. And I love that. I thought it spoke to your entrepreneurial spirit and how you were looking for an opportunity, ways to add value to potential clients. And I also think it's a great example for attorneys who aren't always business or sales focused. Could you discuss the story behind Entrepreneur's Guide to Doing Business in the US and what it taught you?
Sure. I was very fortunate that the law firm where I grew up as an associate, a great New York firm called Curtis Malley Prevost, in 1988, approached me and asked me. So I came out of law school in 84, so I was a fifth-year associate, approached me to relocate to the firm's London office. And its London practice was a fairly traditional finance practice, a number of large UK insurance companies and financial firms that were doing business in the U.S., and so I went there to do a fairly traditional corporate finance practice. But while I was there, through a series of mutual connections, I came across the various, there's outside of the UK's great universities like Oxford and Cambridge and Durham and Edinburgh, are these research parks that are a lot like the Stanford Research Park or the corridor outside of Boston, where they're seeking to develop and commercialize some of the pure research coming out of the laboratory. But what's interesting is, while the Stanford and MIT corridors all have an easy pipeline of private equity leading to either sale or IPO in the United States, and by the way, not much has changed since the early 90s when I was in London and where we are today in the 2020s. In Europe, the pipeline is not as well established. The European IPO market, it's pretty much non-existent. And for many of these emerging technology companies in the UK, they needed to come to the US either or for both to sell their goods and services, but ultimately to attract the type of capital pre-IPO and ultimately IPO opportunities. And so I saw that as a business opportunity. I started spending a lot of time in and around those research corridors outside the British universities, talking to them about doing business in the United States. And I sat down over the course of a month and put together basically a guide that answered a whole bunch of their just initial questions about how to do business in the United States. And then I teamed up with the firm of Grant Thornton and one of the partners there, and we did a series of roadshows up and down Britain at these research parks, talking to them about setting up in the United States. And we built a very good pipeline of really exciting early stage technology companies. And as a result of that, over the course of 3 or 4 years, I eventually left Curtis Malley Prevost with great affection for them, but they really weren't set up to handle these tech companies. Their core practice was still those big established financial firms. And so I set up a firm called Giancarlo and Gleiberman, came back to the United States with my wife to start our family, but also to set up our firm in New York and Washington with two offices and my partner, Paul Gleiberman. And we really were a specialty boutique serving mostly European clients that were tech-based clients. And it was actually through that, one of my clients, Fenix Software, which was a company that made basically an algorithm-based software that calculated how to price currency options that led me to eventually leave the practice of law in 2000, go to Wall Street with a group of partners led by a great entrepreneur, Mickey Gooch, to form a firm called GFI Group, which was basically a global network, and we built it out over the next several years across the globe for the execution and trading of a complex derivative product called a credit default swap. And we took that company public in 2005, and we had our secondary offer in 2006. By 2008, that firm, GFI, had the largest platform for trading over-the-counter credit default swaps in the world. We had about 80% of the world's market share. Even though we were not a trading firm, we were an exchange for things that didn't trade on the exchange. And by the great financial crisis of 2008, we found ourselves right in the middle of it because credit default swaps, there was not a fear they would fail. There was a fear they would work and that the distress of one firm would cause a cascading series of failures across Wall Street. And as a result of that, I wound up testifying several times in front of Congress as to how the marketplace worked. When the market fails, you can blame a lot of people, but you don't blame the stock exchange. In a similar way, there was a lot of blame to go around, but not for the people that ran the market, and that's what we did. And I've got very involved in the drafting of what became Title VII of the Dodd-Frank Act, advising a number of congressional committees on that. And when it passed, I thought, whatever one thinks about the rest of Dodd-Frank, I thought the swaps provisions worked. And I complimented President Obama and the Democratic-controlled Congress on that. And a few years later, when a seat opened up at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which was the way our commissions work, you have so many Republicans, so many Democrats. President Obama was looking for a Republican, but a Republican who supported Dodd-Frank, and there wasn't many of us. And he asked me to serve at the CFTC. I was appointed by President Obama, delighted to be unanimously confirmed at a time when nobody knew who I was. And then 2.5 years later, President Trump named me chairman of the agency. And I was even more delighted, I might even say surprised, to be unanimously confirmed a second time. And when people knew who I was, either they might have known who I was, they didn't know what the CFTC was, the agency I went to, or I hadn't pissed off enough of them in my first 2.5 years. That they denied me that unanimous consent and unanimous approval. So anyway, I then served at the CFTC as its chair from January 2017 to the end of my five-year term in 2019. And in that 2.5 years, we really made some big steps forward at the agency. We launched Lab CFTC, the first dedicated bureau of any federal regulator in Washington focused on financial technology and making our agency smarter and more sophisticated, but also providing an entry point for innovators to come to the agency without fear of sanction or enforcement action, to just be able to talk about innovation and to people that actually understood it themselves. We brought in some of the best and brightest, including Daniel Gorfein is the leader of it. And Lab CFTC did some great work to the extent that, Jacob, I think your listeners will like to hear this. In the late summer of 2017, the CFTC commissioners were doing synthetic Bitcoin mining in the chairman's conference room led by Lab CFTC, just to understand how it worked. Because when we talked about mining, we wanted to make sure we actually understood what we were talking about. And that led us, that and other steps led us to be so much smarter on this when we were approached that fall by two of the large commodities exchanges in the United States, the Chicago Merc and the Chicago Board Options Exchange, about launching Bitcoin futures. And we faced a lot of resistance, some here in the United States, much overseas, especially Europeans, saying, do not launch Bitcoin futures, because if you do, you're legitimizing Bitcoin. And I bristled at that because I don't believe it's regulators' job to legitimize or delegitimize something that's lawful. If Congress wants to ban it, that's one thing. They can deal with the consequences of doing that. But if it's legal, then our job is, we don't have a right to legitimize. Our right, our obligation is to build a regulatory structure around it that works. And so that's what we did. We created what we called heightened scrutiny, but ultimately we greenlighted Bitcoin futures in December of 2017. And I'm very pleased to say now, over 5 years later, that the Bitcoin futures market, the United States, and in many ways, the world's first regulated market for any type of crypto, is today deep, It's liquid, it's transparent, and it's well regulated and well policed. I think that's a tremendous accomplishment, but more than that, I think it is an indication that regulators can engage with crypto and engage successfully with crypto without having to try to ban it or sanction it or suppress it, but actually accept if people want to deal with this, fine. Let's just put a regulatory structure around it that works and get out of the way.
Having spent countless hours with regulators and being in those rooms myself, I have to give a hats off to you and the team at the CFTC for doing that, because I don't think people understand how much pressure there is to keep the status quo going and how difficult it is to take risks like that, frankly, because the upside, there's no upside really, it personally, at least, to doing things like this, to pushing the envelope and saying there's no, this should exist in the market, so we'll go through. And it's a heck of a ton of work, as you alluded to as well. I'd love to just get a bit more granular, Chris, and talk about what you would do. But what does it look like? You're made chair of the CFTC, and there's probably a handful of people in human history that have been made chair of the CFTC. So what do you do when you're appointed a role like this? And I think people could really learn a lot from the principles that you use to approach something like that when they're beginning a role that they previously haven't had an opportunity to practice in.
I think the first thing you do is before you even take the oath, if you make the decision that I made, that I would serve one term, and one term only, and then return to the private sector, then you are so freed to do what you believe is right and what your oath has sworn you to do without having to compromise because you're worried about getting the next job and the next confirmation and who's going to say what to you during that confirmation process. So when President Obama asked me to serve in 2013, I said I would serve one term and one term only. That term began in 2014. Ended in 2019. When President Trump came to me and said, I'd like you to serve as chair, I said, look, I've already committed to serving one term. So if you want me to be chair starting on inauguration day in 2017, I'm still leaving in 2019 at the end of my five-year term. And there was some back and forth because they really wanted me to commit to staying through his first term, which would have been 4 years, which means I would have had an extended mine. But I was able to prevail. And therefore, when I took the oath of office as chair in January 2019, I knew I was leaving in 2019. I knew I had 2.5 years, and I knew I wasn't looking for the next job up the ladder in Washington. There's people in Washington that talk about the revolving door. They say it's a revolving door between people in the private sector going in and out. That's not the revolving door. The revolving door is people in Washington that stay for a lifetime and go from one government job to the next government job. And because they want the next government job, they compromise themselves in the previous government job. I think the right system is the one our founders intended, that people from the private sector go into government, do their best, knowing that what they have to gain or lose is their reputation, but not another government appointment. They do their best and then they leave and go back. And so that freed me up to really say, okay, folks, we don't have a lot of time here. Let's get on with it. Let's follow the mission that Congress laid out for us as best we can. Let's be open-minded. And the other thing I took very seriously is that the CFTC is not like the Treasury Department or another government administration. It's an independent agency. It does not report to the White House. Now, the chair and the commissioners are nominated by the president, but they're confirmed by the Senate, and the agency has dual reporting lines to its oversight committees in the House and Senate and to the White House. And I took very seriously our independence from administration policy. So at one point, the administration was demanding that all agencies freeze their budget or reduce their budget. And I simply said, I can't do that because this agency has had its budget frozen for 4 years. We're underfunded as it is, and we need to move forward with our technology initiative. So I actually asked for an increase. And that's just one example of areas where I was very respectful with the White House and with the Trump administration and the Obama administration, but saw our mission as Congress has laid it out in the law. It's called the Commodities Exchange Act, what we need to do. And I'm going to follow that, and I've sworn to following that. And I do think that one of the things that I'm a bit disappointed in right now is it does seem that independence has been somewhat blurred, and independent agencies like the SEC and the CFTC, but more the SEC, have been more adhering to a government line as opposed to the independent line that I think, that I know, is the way these agencies are meant to operate. It's, anyway, so the two things that I brought with me is that sense of independence, both for our agency and for my own duty, independence from the prevailing, the blowing winds of politics, but an adherence, a strict adherence to the mission set out in our governing statute, the Commodities Exchange Act.
And when you joined the CFTC in 2014, I believe that was shortly after the departure of former CFTC Chair Gary Gensler, who, as we all know, is now the chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission. And if we can talk about the SEC and how motivations for different people could lead to different things, but I'd love to know if anything you noticed that Chair Gensler got right in that role at the CFTC and where you saw room for improvement when you were at the CFTC. And the reason I'm asking that is I think it would be interesting to see maybe what principles have been brought to the SEC or maybe how things have been different in his approach, because there are the lectures that he gave at MIT that people speak about often where, oh, some are securities, some aren't. And now there's the whole idea that everything is a security. So just curious your thoughts when you joined the CFTC shortly after Chair Gensler's departure, what did you notice?
Yeah, my public statements during my time at the CFTC are actually quite clear on the very question you've asked. I've said and continue to believe that the CFTC's implementation of the legally required provisions of Dodd-Frank accomplished by Chair Gensler are remarkable. Enormous amount of the statutory duties that Dodd-Frank imposed upon the CFTC were accomplished during his tenure, and many of them, I think, were accomplished well. And I've tipped my hat to him and continue to tip my hat to him for that. I don't believe, however, that all of the implementation was done optimally. I think in some cases, including and especially the trade execution requirement for swaps, was done with an exchange trading model in mind against the clear language of Dodd-Frank, which refers to swaps being executed through any means of interstate commerce, which could include a telephone transaction. And I do think, and I've written about this extensively. I wrote a white paper on where I think the CFTC got this wrong. So I haven't pulled my punches in where I think some of the implementation went wrong. But I also have been quite clear that I still tip my hat, having run a government agency and knowing how hard it is to implement statutory required rules, his ability to get that done. Now, those were statutory required changes, and so they had the force of law behind them. I do think without statutory required changes, I do think it's a chair has to be far more circumspect and reserved in pushing for wholesale market changes. And since much of the implementation had been accomplished by my predecessors, not only Chair Gensler, but his successor, Tim Massid, I didn't have a lot of Dodd-Frank left over to accomplish, but still finished a few final rule changes that were needed.
And as a new commissioner, you prepared two white papers that fleshed out a lot of your regulatory agenda. And I love that the idea that they were white papers as well. What prompted you to write these? And did any of the principles in the papers inform your perspective on crypto regulation?
Two things. One is I've had a lifelong habit when I approach a problem to use the process of writing to work intellectually through the problem. And so part of it was, as a minority commissioner, not having the initiative of a chair to move an agenda, I started the writing process to help me work through the issue. And the issue specifically was this issue of execution of transactions in swaps. I then decided about 3/4 of the way through that I would actually publish my writings. So I turned what was mostly my internal musings into a white paper. I think that white paper surprised a lot of people. I don't think, at least my staff couldn't find any instance of a commissioner ever writing a white paper previously. I think it was well received and well commented upon. And I do think it influenced, and I think it still influences, and I write about this in my book, in a funny kind of way, I think it led to the right approach to trade execution, but through the wrong series of steps, right outcome, wrong process. A lot of times you have a right process, wrong outcome. I think in this case, you had the right outcome, wrong process. I don't want to get into it. We don't have enough time, but I've written about it in my book. I think the CFTC came out on the right side of this. And I do think my white paper had some influence there. And it certainly laid out some markers for when I took over as chairman, people knew where I stood on many issues that perhaps they wouldn't have if I hadn't written that.
In 2019, you were one of the loudest regulators to speak on the need to embrace blockchain, and you largely attributed to the financial crisis. Could you explain why? And one thing I've heard you mention in interviews before is the $400 billion written against the failure of Lehman. The net exposure was less than $9 billion, but that wasn't known. They didn't know that at the case, and the policy response might have been very different than what emerged, but the technology didn't exist. And when you gave that example, I think that's something 99, probably 0.9% of the population isn't aware of or didn't know. So I'd love if you could just explain and tell that story.
Yeah. So let me explain what that is. So first of all, to understand this, I'm just going to take a minute and explain what credit default swaps are. Credit default swaps are basically a type of insurance against the default of a borrower. The reason they're different than insurance is, unlike an insurance policy, which once you take it out, you can cancel it, but you can't trade it. A credit default swaps, you can write that insurance and be the beneficiary, but you can also, if you no longer have that concern, you could sell that to somebody else who can then transfer that. And the major Wall Street banks would write credit default, basically insurance, for lenders to other banks that those lenders could then use as protection in case their loans went bad. And at the time of the failure of Lehman Brothers, it was calculated there was about $400 billion of protection written by other banks on the failure of Lehman Brothers. That was what they called the gross notional outstanding amount. And they got that figure because banks at the end of the year would report how much they had written on the failure of another institution. And so they added, basically the Fed added those all up. And at the time of the crisis, they said, oh, holy crap, if Lehman fails, the other banks on Wall Street are going to have to pay out $400 billion. And let's just think about that for a second, because if Morgan Stanley fails, that must be $800 billion. If JP Morgan fails, that could be $1.2 trillion. And they basically said, wow, we've got to fill these banks with cash so that if there's a run on them, they'll survive. And that led to what was called the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, where basically the Fed came in the way a fire brigade would come in if a house is on fire and wet down all the surrounding houses. So in this case, they basically filled all the banks with cash and made them borrow the money from the Fed so that there would be cash there so there wouldn't be a run on the bank. We now know that the net exposure, not the gross. Okay, so there were $400 billion of protection written against the failure of Lehman Brothers, but those banks then went out and reinsured those exposures. So the net exposure was not $400 billion, it was $9 billion. But we didn't have that information at the time of the crisis. And in fact, most crises are usually a crisis of a failure of information. Right, the famous scene in Mary Poppins when the boy wants his tuppence back and the bank doesn't give it to him, and the rumor goes around that the bank doesn't have the tuppence, and so everybody demands their money back. That's a bank crisis, and it's based upon a lack of information. In 2008, if we knew in 2008 that the real exposure of a failure of Lehman Brothers was $9 billion and not $400 billion, it would have been easy to we would have had different policy choices. One is we could have let them fail. It wouldn't have brought down Wall Street. We could have let them be sold. A lot of people would have paid $9 billion to buy Lehman Brothers. The Fed could have lent it to them. Instead of lending trillions of dollars in TARP. They could have lent $9 billion to Lehman Brothers. So there were so many policy choices we didn't have because we didn't have the information. Okay, that's the background. Here's the light bulb that went off in Chris Giancarlo's head. If all those credit default exposures had been on a blockchain, we would have known instantly back in 2008 that the true exposure of Lehman Brothers was $9 billion. But we didn't have them on a blockchain. We had them on balance sheets of thousands of financial institutions all over the country and all over the world. We didn't have the ability to aggregate them. That's when this all started coming together to me. That's when in 2010, 2011, I started working on this, thinking about this, reading about a blockchain. I got to the CFTC in 2014, immediately started thinking and writing about this, in worked with then Chairman Tim Massid on the 2015 designation of Bitcoin as a commodity, subsequently upheld by U.S. federal courts, now the law of the land. But a lot of that, at least on my part, derived from my experience in the great financial crisis and this notion we need to move the financial system away from that old architecture that I talked about at the very beginning of our podcast, Jacob, a few minutes ago, an architecture that kept these records of who owned what on the separate, unconnected balance sheets of all these financial institutions and put them on one centralized, distributed ledger, a blockchain. And so in 2015 led to the designation of Bitcoin. And then in 2017, when I finally had the gavel as chair, the formation of Lab CFTC and all our subsequent work after that. So that was my eureka moment. It was in the great financial crisis. In many ways, just as for Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever he or she may be, it was out of the financial crisis, the notion of a distributed ledger arrived. On my own very separate journey, it was out of the financial crisis in the global credit default swaps market where my career was that I had this eureka moment that this new architecture could be a huge boon to everybody, but also regulators. Because ultimately what I'm saying is, had regulators access to distributed ledger technology, they would have had so much better ability to understand what was going on and respond to what was going on without having to take all those trillions of taxpayer funds and apply it to solve the problem.
And it is amazing how that transition from gross notional amount to net could have happened so easy if there was a blockchain, if there was some system on the back end. How do you see something like that evolving? And why have we not seen that happen yet, where there is a regulator-run blockchain that is evaluating transactions or just maintaining sort of market structure on the back end? Because if it's all public, I don't know if that'll necessarily work just from commercial, competitive perspectives. But why do you think we haven't seen that happen? And if we do, what could it look like?
Well, you just put your finger on what I would say is my biggest disappointment in the current political culture we're in right now. You hear every day after day banging on about how dangerous this new technology is and how it's a technology for fraudsters and scammers and money launderers, yada, 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 yada. Every financial system has its utilization by fraudsters and scammers and money launderers, everyone, including the dollar, in its cash form. That cannot be a reason that we, especially as Americans who have historically embraced innovation, do not take hold of this and use it for all the good purposes, including the one I just mentioned. So my biggest disappointment is, yes, we need to deal with the bad actors. And I think I did a pretty good job of that when I was in government. But we also need to embrace this for how it can make us as regulators better at doing our job. We need to embrace this for how, as a society, we can use this to further financial inclusion, bring more people into financial means. We need to use this for how it can lower costs, take out some of the huge amount of rent seeking and rent collecting that takes place in our current financial system. It's ridiculous that if we can send a text message or a photograph anywhere in the world in seconds, it's still cheaper and easier to get $500 from here to London by getting on a plane, putting the money in our pocket and getting on a plane, than it is to send a wire. And it's a lot cheaper because of all the rent collecting that takes place to move money around the globe. While I'm sympathetic to all the concerns about a new technology and how it can be misused, I deeply am frustrated by people in senior positions that ought to be calling for engagement with this technology to improve our financial system, because there's so much that can be gained for our societies. And if that's not reason enough, at least for regulators themselves.
I couldn't agree more. And I remember when I first learned of Bitcoin and how it worked with to avoid double spends and the back end and all the tech side of it. I remember thinking, oh, it works like how the banks work, right? Very efficient settlement and everything. And that's not how the banks work. And so it was really shocking and eye-opening for me to just see how the existing system has been built in a patchwork manner and really hasn't adapted over time.
Yeah. And let me say something, Jacob. I want to be crystal clear. There's an important role for banks in the digital future of value, a very important role. People that have $10,000 that want to buy a $30,000 car are still going to need to borrow. People that have $100,000 and want to buy a $400,000 house are still going to need a mortgage. People that have $1 million and want to start a $4 million business are still going to need to borrow money, and banks are going to have to provide cash flow loans and all kinds of other services. There's still a very important role for banks and for fractional banking. And by the way, investors that want to earn a return on their money are still going to find ways to collect, assemble that money with others, often organized by a bank, to put that money to use. So I think it's a very important role. But in a funny kind of way, we've allowed banks to go into a different part of the financial system in addition to fractional banking, and that's moving money around the globe. And the process of moving your money around the globe conducted by our existing correspondent banking system is expensive. It's filled with friction. It's filled with redundancy. There's a lot of data collection provided to regulators that has some value. The dirty little secret is our current AML KYC regime is not very effective. And so this new technology, I don't think threatens the core function of banking, but I do think it has the potential to drastically improve the way we move money around the globe, the way money is stored, the way money is recorded, the way money is transferred. And I think that will be threatening to certain functions of banks. New technologies do that. I do think the smarter banks, and I certainly speak to many of them here in New York City, already have their head around that. They're already focusing on a digital future, and they survive. And I do think it would be a mistake for a mature economy like the United States, because we're fearful about disintermediation of some of the services of our financial institutions, will resist this innovation, while other countries around the world that perhaps are less dominated by financial services will open their doors to it and ultimately disintermediate us as the world's most essential nation because we've been resistant to change. I think the role of policymakers has to go into this open-minded, open-eyed, clear-eyed about what parts of our economy it's going to challenge, what other parts of our economy it's going to enhance, and work through those issues in a thoughtful, intelligent way. I think our banking industry, if they know that they can't use the regulatory state to slow down this advance, will actually participate more robustly in the movement into the future. Right now, a lot of people refer to regulation by enforcement. I saw a phrase the other day that I think is really apt. I think it's a New York lawyer, Steve Lofchi, who said it's regulation by anxiety. And I think there's a lot to that. And I think in that regulation by anxiety, there's a lot of stasis. There's a lot of inertia. And inertia is not good for the world's leading economy. Inertia is not healthy for us to explore this technology and deliver its benefits while taking steps to control its shortcomings. And I think it's incumbent on us to move away from anxiety toward mature, thoughtful leadership that says, okay, the technology is here. It's not going away. Let's engage with it in a way that is clear-eyed about its dangers and shortcomings, but also open-minded and exploratory about its positive benefits. I mentioned just one. Imagine if we had not gone through the financial crisis because we had that tool at our disposal. And so we need to be open-minded about what can be done. And I think it's time to move beyond anxiety to mature, sensible, thoughtful, balanced leadership, and away from a suppressive approach to much more of an engagement approach to this innovation.
And there is that tension for policymakers, and I sympathize with them with this idea of disintermediation, where our entire system is based on regulating intermediaries, having that figurehead that you can point to and say, you're responsible for this activity, and you're the ones we're going to talk to if anything goes wrong. How do you see that being a fundamental tension going forward, or how do you think that will be navigated in the future, Chris?
It's interesting you say that, because this regulation by intermediary is such an analog approach to regulation. If you think about it in an analog world, how regulators, and it doesn't even have to be financial regulators, it can be any type of regulators, approach regulation. They basically look at a market ecosystem and they say, okay, where are the intermediaries? Where are the monopolies? Where are the choke points and the bottlenecks? Fine. We will require them to register with us. We will assign to them a whole series of responsibilities, including information gathering. And in return, we'll give them licenses, which are little mini monopolies, to operate in the system. And regulators, therefore, become highly dependent on those license holders, those monopolies, so much so that there's a degree of regulatory capture. And it becomes a fairly immobile kind of system of regulation. And for many people, it's about getting the license. And I think in the long run, it's a degree unhealthy. What this new digital technology allows is to move away from government-granted monopolies, because regulators can move from being highly dependent and, quite frankly, reactive based upon information they gather from their license holders, to a system where regulators can become nodes on distributed ledger blockchains and can see all activity, perhaps subject to appropriate privacy requirements, et cetera. And therefore, instead of having to rely on these monopolies, regulators can be directly interacting with the market itself. They can use the same tools that our social media platforms use, big data analysis, pattern recognition, artificial intelligence, to actually see the marketplace directly rather than being highly reliant on these license holders. And so I think if we get out of this mindset of intermediary regulation, I called it a digital mindset when I was at the CFTC, and smart regulation, where regulators become direct observers of market activity and directly interacting with the market to fulfill their statutory required missions, but without being highly dependent on these license holder monopolies. But that's a mindset that is going to take time to come. I'd say that most of the regulators I've dealt with in the global sphere are very much in this mindset of highly dependent on the monopolies. And part of it is self-interest, because when they finish their role in government, where do they go get hired? It's by these monopolies. I think we really need to move away from that to much more of a direct digital network type of regulation. And it will come when the next generation behind me and your generation comes into the regulatory world, because you grew up in a networked world. You understand the power of digital networks. It may have begun with trading game tokens, but you understand the power of networks, and you'll bring that into, you and your colleagues will bring that into the regulatory state when you get there.
I did a podcast on the history of U.S. securities regulation a couple weeks ago, and it was interesting to see the impetus was actually for creating a lot of the regulation was protecting the incumbents, protecting the actual market participants, not the consumers themselves. And really what you spoke to there rings quite a few bells and aligns with that. One thing I wanted to ask you, just because you are such a student of history, and I think you've spent the time to understand the printing press and understand everything that sort of happened throughout history and the trends, we've seen, especially in the dot-com bubble, right? All these technologies were created. There was home delivery, grocery service, web TV, but they were too early. It took subsequent years, and maybe this is my naive impatience, but it seems like crypto's current stage in development is in that early stage and isn't quite moving to the next stage at this point. Where would you say we are today, and where are we heading? Are we on a path that you've seen throughout history?
I totally agree with you. I think we're in an early stage. This, where we are, reminds me of the period in the early aughts, 2000 to 2005, right after the dot-com bubble burst. You may not remember this, but I remember it very well. There was a lot of excitement in 1999 going into early 2000 for companies like pets.com, and every little application of internet activity was going to be its own dot-com and ready for IPO. And the bubble burst in March of 2000. And I think Time Magazine called it dot-bomb. And people were saying what a joke pets.com was. Pets.com didn't fail because people didn't want to buy pet supplies online. But in 2000, they had to buy pet supplies online using dial-up modems, putting their credit card information into some website that had no validation. There was no PayPal. There was no Amazon. And it was over the next 5 years that infrastructure of pay, of Amazon, of 4G, and then 5G technology came about that made internet commerce, e-commerce, a reality. And when pets.com failed, I think I've seen the figures, there was about 300 million people using e-commerce in 2000. By 2010, if I have my numbers right, I think the figure was about 2 billion. And by 2020, so now we're talking two decades later, the figure is 5 or 6 billion. The majority of the people on Earth today are using e-commerce. That's a great CAGR, compound annual growth rate, from 300 million to 5 billion in 20 years, but it took the build out of that infrastructure. I think we're somewhere in those early 2001, 2002 years for a comparison. I mean, think the fallout of last year of FTX and others was like the dot-com bubble bursting. The early hype got ahead of itself. The underlying infrastructure wasn't there. And I think we're now in the hard years of building. And it's almost better that a lot of the buzz has moved on to AI and other things, because it provides the opportunity for the serious builders to build out this architecture. But notwithstanding that, I have every belief this is not going away. This is coming. As I said before, to think that the internet has changed everything we know about e-commerce, everything we know about social networking, everything we know about communications, everything we know about entertainment, but somehow it's not going to do it to banking and finance and money is just naive. It is going to do it, but there's a lot more infrastructure that needs to be built. And there's a lot of more generational change that needs to be. We still have our oversight of our financial markets is pretty septuagenarian. And I'm not criticizing people of either party, but we have a leadership class that grew up in the area of branch banking, of passbook savings accounts, of check writing, and they didn't grow up in a networked world. And I think they're struggling. The world they grew up in worked pretty well for them. And I think there's a struggle to do this, but that will just change with time. Life is a conveyor belt, and I don't mean any disrespect, but those septuagenarians will eventually exit the scene, and we'll have younger generations moving in that have a better understanding and I think a more balanced understanding. Yeah, there's dangers in this technology, but there's also tremendous opportunity. And are we going to let our economic adversaries and our economic competitors to develop it? China has got more patents on the blockchain than any other country in the world. The Chamber of Digital Commerce has done studies and published on this, analyzing patent applications. Patent applications in the U.S. Patent Office for blockchain technology. So are we going to allow this digital future to be dominated by our economic competitors and economic adversaries, or are we going to dominate? I think ultimately the American spirit is going to break through this inertia we have now and reassert itself and take charge of this.
I agree. And I think just from 2 points on what you said, the first is the infrastructure. And what I always love is a litmus test to ask people, how do you buy Bitcoin? Just as a litmus test to how do you interact with the crypto ecosystem? 10 years ago, it was Mt. Gox, or you'd find a obscure site online that you could use. 5 years ago, it was a non-regulated exchange, but one that existed and you could trust them or not. 2 years ago, it was, in Canada at least, a regulated exchange. And now it's moving forward, and it's much easier now than it was 10 years ago and 5 years ago. And in 10 years, interacting with the blockchain ecosystem will be even easier going forward. So I think that itself is really interesting. And then there's the idea of—
Jacob, can I just comment on something you just said? How do you interact? I'll share with your audience, I own no crypto. And there's a reason for that. I wish I did, but when I was chairman of the CFTC and we were writing rules and I felt it would be inappropriate for me to have any conflict in owning crypto, even though other commodities regulated by the CFTC may be owned by CFTC staffers. Petroleum is a commodity and its futures markets are regulated by the CFTC, but you couldn't prevent staffers from owning petroleum because they couldn't get to work. And similarly, you couldn't prevent them from owning gold because they couldn't own jewelry. So you can't bar people from owning commodities. But I felt as chair, it would be inappropriate for me. And since I've left the commission, but I maintain a public life where I speak frequently about digital assets and commodities, I've kept to that policy of not owning crypto. Now, had I bought it when I was first began studying it, I'd probably be broadcasting you today from Miami Beach or Palm Beach, at least. But that's all right. But I think it is important that people understand I speak about an asset class without seeking to benefit from its appreciation and value from a policy I adopted back in 2014 that I've maintained since.
One thing just on that point, Chris, I think a lot of people mistakenly associate the speculative nature of crypto with the underlying blockchain technology. And that distinction needs to be made in order to have the approach that we've been speaking this entire podcast about, which is let's embrace the positives of this technology. There doesn't need to necessarily be a token in many cases. There doesn't need to be a speculative nature. The problem, I think, is, which as you mentioned just now, was it's so easy. And when you can raise billions or make billions of dollars quickly, it's very tempting to take that approach. But now that we could be in this prolonged crypto winter, whether or not that persists, it opens up the opportunity for builders to just focus on what's really important, and what they're doing is building a product. So rather than building that infrastructure, frankly, that the ecosystem needs to benefit and for us as people to actually receive the benefit that this technology promises.
Let's even tease that out a little bit. If over the last 10 years, people believe that the future of automobile transportation was electric, and if they just read what they read in the newspaper about government efforts to drive people away from internal combustion engines to electric engines, the only way, there are several ways, but probably one of the most popular ways of expressing that expectation for the future was to own Tesla stock. Right. And as a result, Tesla became far more valuable than General Motors, even though it never produced as many cars, it didn't have the franchise. But that was a result of people basically expressing the view that the future of automotive transportation was electric. And I believe many members of government, including representatives in Congress, bought Tesla stock at the same time they were writing rules that would move more of us in the automobile. Well, is it any different that people that believe the future of the architecture of the future of finance is digital networks expressing that view by owning tokens in digital networks like Bitcoin, Ethereum, otherwise? I don't think it's any different, nor is it more disreputable. If they're the people in the fields building that infrastructure, is it wrong for them to express that view of the future by owning these instruments? I don't think it's wrong. And yet somehow speculation in crypto is held out as if it's contemptible. And yet many members of Congress have been holding Tesla stock for the last 10 years while they're writing rules to move us out of our internal combustion engine. I think one has to, again, go back to a more balanced approach. It's not unreasonable if you believe that this architecture, is the digital future is a digital architecture, as I do, to express that view in the holding of digital tokens.
One of the last things I wanted to touch on with you is the idea of democratic values and the digital dollar project. And I know you've done quite a bit of work on that. So thank you, frankly, for that, because I think that will play a huge role in my life and my children's life and their children. But you've spoken a lot on activity-based regulation, and you've seen up close how important it is to encode democratic values and economic privacy into digital money. What is this activity-based regulation, and what could it look like in practice in a way that does achieve these goals?
So we go back to the analogy I pointed before, how in an analog world, regulators regulate by basically licensing entities. I hope in a digital future, they can move away from that entity-based style of regulation to an activity-based style regulation by actually identifying the activities that are impermissible or to be sanctioned and look and focus on the activities rather than empowering and being highly reliant on licensed entities. When we think about, I also talked earlier in our conversation about the future that I believe will be a kaleidoscope of both centralized and decentralized systems of value. Some of those centralized ones run by government, some run by big tech companies, some run by large banks. All of the centralized systems, whether they're stable coins or central bank digital currency, will be enormous honeypots of information that many people are going to want to get at. Some of those people want to get at will be bad actors, but some will be governments and some will be big tech companies. And so we formed the Digital Dollar Project not to advocate for the U.S. to adopt a central bank digital currency. The Digital Dollar Project does not call for a government-issued digital dollar. What we do is call for the U.S. government to get actively engaged in the development of global standards for what digital currencies look like, whether they're sovereign or non-sovereign. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan, 501c3 organization that is really the only organization asking the following question. How do we future-proof the dollar for that world of that digital kaleidoscope of systems of value? How do we preserve its reserve currency status that is really the foundation for the American way of life? And most importantly, how do we enhance the values that I think the dollar has traditionally stood for both at home and abroad? Values of free enterprise, values of free trade, and values of economic liberty and privacy in lawful transactions. We believe that any instrument that is based on the dollar, that references the dollar, that is the dollar in a digital network format, must achieve those goals. And we are as concerned about stablecoins as we are about CBDC. There's a very shallow calculus in some corners of Washington's political environment that says CBDC bad, but stablecoins good. And then maybe there's others that say stablecoins bad, CBDC good, as if one or the other is going to be more protecting of our liberty. As we've seen with social media, government is only too happy to lean on private companies to say what they want them to say and not say what they don't want them to say. The same temptation will be there when government is licensing stablecoin operators to say to them, hey, you like your license, you better not let people buy ammunition, or you better not let people fund abortions, or you better not let people fund right to life, or you better not let them fund that candidate because he's a bad guy. And it could go on. And the argument will be, but they're not government. They're not subject to the Constitution in the same way that right now government is saying, hey, we can tell them what to say because they're private actors in the social media context. And so I think the danger to our constitutional liberties. If you don't have economic privacy and economic liberty, you don't have liberty, right? Our Constitution talks about free speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion. If you can't subscribe to the publication you want to because government may be censoring or controlling your subscription, you don't have freedom of speech. If you can't pay dues to an organization you wish to belong to, then you don't have freedom of assembly. If government is surveilling and censoring your contributions to a church or synagogue or mosque, then you don't have freedom of religion. And so these economic choices, if it's in a dollar, and that's what the digital dollar project is all about, is as we project the dollar into this digital future, how to preserve these democratic values that we believe in, but we're already seeing eroded in the analog bank-based system. Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary Yellen, was just on Capitol Hill, and she was asked whether, under her supervision, FinCEN had instructed banks to surveil and indeed censor certain transactions using certain keywords, like legal sporting goods stores that happen to sell ammunition, or and the names of them would be pulled out for scrutiny by the banks, or religious names. And so if the government is already leaning on banks to surveil, censor, and even control financial activity in our analog system, how much greater will they be able to do it in a digital system? And I don't care whether it's a stable coin or a CBDC, the same power will be there. That's why we need to make sure the values. I like to talk about drawing the distinction between the value of a digital currency and the system and the values. And I think we've been spending a lot of time talking about lowering friction, lowering cost, about the value, but we need to start spending an equal amount of time talking about the values of this. We don't want the digital network of value, the internet of value, to let us down the way that the internet of information brought us to Web 2, where these giant centralizers are now telling us what to think and what information to digest and what information we're not privy to. We don't want the same thing to happen when large tech companies, whether they be stablecoin operators or large bank conglomerates or governments, are basically running centralized systems of value. So the same danger is there in stablecoins, it's in CBDC, but also the same opportunity. And again, I come back to my general outlook on life. I see the glass is half full. I always see this as an opportunity, and I never want to hold still because I'm fearful. And I at heart, I follow a Christian ethos, and the one phrase that it repeats over and over in the New Testament is, do not be afraid. And that's my outlook on life. I don't want to be afraid of this technology. I want to take hold of it and make it serve our fellow man rather than enslave our fellow man. I think that is the seminal point. We began this conversation, is this time different? Are we at an inflection point? I think we are. I think the inflection point is we have a technology right in front of us that has the potential to enslave us if we don't take charge of it. But I think it also has the potential to free us and liberate us and make us even more able to live free lives as free citizens in democratic societies if we take it and use it for its best purposes.
Very well put. And you could almost expand on that, right? If you encode those values in a digital form of value, that can bring this opportunity not only to North America, right? It can bring it to people across the world.
Jacob, let's think about that. Just as you said it, if we were to create, if we were to require that any digital instrument based upon the dollar, referencing the dollar, linked to the dollar, protect our basic economic liberty, was not subject to surveillance or censorship or control by either commercial institutions or governments, people around the world that aspire to liberty and freedom would seek to own that instrument. We could empower the dollar as the world's reserve currency for three more generations, not necessarily because its value, but because of the values that encapsulated. And I think that's the opportunity. Let's enhance the dollar because we get the values right in the digital systems of money.
And it's such a political talking point now with the immigration crisis and the border. But if you zoom out in the big picture, people are voting with their feet. People are, and I spoke to someone who was an illegal immigrant in the U.S., they're jumping from 20-foot walls to make it to the U.S., taking all these risks and spending months of time making this journey. They're voting with their feet. They want to move to a land of opportunity, and bringing that opportunity to the rest of the world could lead to a much better society, much safer, much more equal society in general. There are counterpoints too, right? When you have freedom, you do run risks. But I think if you're a rational optimist, and I'd say that majority of people are good actors, that brings a lot of good to the world. So I think it's such an important project that you're doing.
Let's not let these people down, right? That have taken that risk. Let's people that yearn to be free, let's make the dollar the currency they aspire to hold.
Yep. All right, Chris, last two questions for you. The first is about habits. And I love your point earlier about writing. And I think I'm going to begin adopting that more when I'm facing a difficult problem. So I'd love to hear if there are any other habits that you have used that have helped you cultivate a successful career.
So my grandmother, who I was very fond of, used to say to me when I was a little boy, always walk on the sunny side of the street. She'd take me by the hand and we'd go shopping. And if one side of the seat was shady, the other side was sunny, she goes, let's go walk on the sunny side and enjoy the sunshine. And I think that's a metaphor for life. I've always tried to stay away from negative approaches, negative impulses, negative work environments. You're formed by the institutions you associate with. I've always tried to stay away from negative influences, negative environments. I don't want to sound Pollyanna-ish or like a goody two-shoes, but I've just tried to live my life in the sunlight with a positive approach. It can't be all the time. There's sometimes we get down and things don't go right, but generally keep a positive approach, live in the sunlight, work in the sunlight, surround yourself with healthy and positive people is, I think, the number one thing for me. I married a woman who I fell in love with, who is just a ray of sunshine, and we've been together now. We'll be celebrating our 35th wedding anniversary, and we've got a wonderful family. And we just try to keep things positive and bright and think the best. And sometimes life hit you with the hardest things, and we've suffered our share of disappointments. But stay positive, live in the sunlight is number one. Number two is, I would say to young people, your 20s and early 30s are the time to learn your craft, whatever that may be. If you're going into law, learn to be a good lawyer. If you're going into architecture, learn architecture. If you're going to technology, learn to be a good technologist. Use your first 6 or 7 years out of school learning your business and becoming good at your business. Don't worry about where your career is going to take you. Go to the best platform. If you want to code, go to the place where really good coding is being done. Learn from the best. Once you've mastered your craft, your career will take you where it's meant to go. Your reputation for being a good lawyer, your capability as being a good lawyer, capabilities being a good coder, whatever it may be, as a physician, as a good healthcare provider, will take you. But focus when you get out of school, your first few years, on learning your craft and working hard to learn your craft. On a personal level, seek love, find love, and live in love with the people that love you back and in a healthy environment. And then just build your life where you want to go. That's the other thing, is have a free mind. Put aside the shifting winds of public opinion that just whirl around us where you think, should I do this that's publicly acceptable? Forget all that. That will change on a dime tomorrow. You can't live by public opinion. You have to say, who am I and what are the things that interest me? I've never had a master plan for my career. I set out to be a lawyer. As I mentioned, I worked at Curtis Mallet Prevost, but then and I got great training there. I then had the opportunity to set up my own firm to serve those technology clients. And then I got an offer to build a company on Wall Street from someone who I got to know during my law practice and liked very much and had a big vision. And I went out there. So I didn't expect to go into business. I spent 14 years on Wall Street, built a very successful firm, took that company public, and had great fortune that I never expected, but it was terrific. And then found myself in the middle of a financial crisis. And as a result of that, went into my third career as a regulator. And that was never, I never aspired to do that, but that's where it went. And now I'm in my fourth career as an author and a public figure and speaking out. And who knows where the next opportunity will come. And I've always thought it might become a farmer. So who knows, maybe that's what I'll do next. But there's no master plans. Live each day fully, become good at what you do, find happiness in the people around you. And as Louis Armstrong said, it is a wonderful world, and things will work those way out.
I think that's a beautiful way to end it, Chris. Thank you so much for speaking with me. Thank you for all the work you do. I know personally, I've learned quite a bit from you and your career, from your book, from the public speaking that you do, which I've followed for a few years now. So I just wanted to say thank you for that and for being so generous with your time today. I really enjoyed the conversation and took a lot away from it.
I thank you.